welcome you to today's internet seminar, which will focus on greener cleanups, EPA's methodology for understanding and reducing a project's environmental footprint, which has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Jean Mount, and I work in that very same office at EPA, and I'll be helping to kick off and moderate today's seminar. The formal presentation will begin with some introductory comments by Carlos Pachón in just a few minutes. But while we give a few latecomers a last minute to hop on, I'll cover some basic housekeeping items and instructions. As I mentioned earlier, if you haven't done so already, you'll need to download or pull up a copy of the presentation materials for today's session. When you registered for today's event, you were directed to the seminar's homepage, which was a description of the event, a listing of our presenters, their contact info, and there were also links at the bottom of that page to either download it as a PowerPoint or PDF file. There's also a button that appears on the left side that says Go to Seminar. If you click that, you can actually identify yourself and pull up the slides in a web browser window. So I want to remind everybody that that homepage is there. You can use it to contact any of the presenters or myself at any time. And if you need to get a copy of the slides for later reference, again, you can find that on the seminar homepage. So with that, I'm going to ask everybody to move along to slide number 2 in the PowerPoint presentation. And as you probably have picked up on with all of our CLUIN seminars, each individual participant will navigate through the materials at verbal cues for our instructors. So again, if you're just joining us, we're on slide number 2. Those of you on the phone lines, we ask that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We do have time for Q&A, and at that point, you'll be able to unmute, and we'll provide reminders on how to unmute. But until then, we ask you to keep your phone lines muted using your own mute button or the star 6 command. When we need to unmute, it's pound 6. But until then, it's star 6 to keep it muted. We also ask that you don't place the call on hold. There might be background music or commercials that will play. If you need to, you can simply disconnect and redial into the phone lines. But until we get to the point for Q&A, please keep your phone muted using the star 6 command. Again, I'm on slide number 2 in today's presentation materials. For those of you who are joining us by phone, you'll have the chance to ask questions out loud, but many of you are participating with the streaming simulcast, meaning you're listening to us through your computer speakers. If you have a question or a comment, you don't have to necessarily worry about muting your line, but you'll need to be able to move through the materials and ask questions via your web browser. So when you look at the presentation materials loaded in a web browser window, you'll see a series of numbered links that appear on the left side. You can use those to navigate through the slides. Again, we're on slide number 2. Or you can use the icons that appear in buttons, orange buttons at the top. The single arrow pointing to the right moves you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left moves you backwards one slide. The icon with a large question mark in it, as long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, if you click that question mark button, a new window will open up, which will allow you to type up an electronic question or comment. You can use that question mark icon to submit a comment or question at any point in time. When we get to the appropriate breaks for Q&A, one of us will read that question out loud on your behalf to the presenters so that they can answer it. Again, we would encourage you to submit the questions or comments as early as you like electronically so we can have a nice queue built up when we get to those breaks for Q&A. You can also use that question mark icon to report any technical difficulties you may experience. Just be sure to include a telephone number where you can be reached so that our support staff can reach out and help troubleshoot the problems. As I mentioned, our presenters will be indicating as they move through the slides. Again, I'm on slide number 2. So you'll need to manually move through the materials at our verbal cues. There will be time for Q&A. We'll provide reminders on how to unmute at that point. Again, it's star 6 to remain muted until we get to those breaks for Q&A. When we are all said and done for today's presentation, I'm going to point people to a few important links, one of them being a resource page where you can download the slides and a number of other references for today's session, and then the second link being a short feedback form. If you're attempting to get credit for participating in today's CLUIN seminar, the person who just said not yet, we can hear you, you're not muted. Please place your phone line on mute using the star 6 command. Okay, thank you. If you're looking for credit, again, you want to hang tight to the very end of the seminar. Before we close things out, I'll provide instructions on how you can submit feedback and receive a confirmation message for your own records that may help you in earning CEUs or PDHs for today's session. The last reminder I have for today is that today's CLUIN seminar will be recorded and archived. In about 1 to 2 weeks, you will automatically receive an email from me as soon as that free archive is available for download and replay online. Those are the end of the official reminders I have for today's session. I will make one last plea. Please, please, please place your phone lines on mute using the star 6 command if you have not done so already. And with that, I'm going to turn things over to Carlos Pachón, who will be our first speaker today. And Carlos is joining us also from the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. And I'll leave you with everyone on slide number 3. Carlos, if you're ready, please take over.
They were talking about me before.
And thank you, Jean.
We are talking about you, ma'am. We can hear you. So it's star 6 to mute your line. Thank you. Go ahead, Carlos.
Thanks, Jean. Can you hear me?
We can.
Very well. Thank you. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome again to the webinar on greener cleanups on the EPA's methodology for understanding and reducing a project's environmental footprint. As my colleague Jean mentioned, I'm with the Superfund Technology Innovation and Field Services and Division, part of the Superfund program. And our role is to advance best practices in the remediation of contaminated sites. One of the areas I lead in this effort is advancing the practice of green remediation. I've been working on this topic and others, of course, but on this topic specifically since about 2008. Of course, I've not been working alone. I've been working with a lot of colleagues and people inside and outside the agency. And a lot of the folks that have been pivotal in getting this methodology complete are some of the fellow speakers on the call today. In order of presentation, first we have Doug Sutton, who has provided support to our team over the last 3 years performing footprint evaluations and drafting the methodology. His team is also lead support at EPA for remedy optimization analysis, and the methodology has benefited from those experiences as well. Next speaker after Doug is Karen Sherman, who is with our Region 9 offices. She is with the RCRA program, Corrective Action Program, at Region 9 in San Francisco. Karen took a great initiative in performing some of the initial critical pilot projects that have led to the development of the methodology, and she's been played a very important role in its development. The next speaker after Karen is Kira Lynch. Kira Lynch is with our EPA Region 10 office. She's currently with the Office of Research and Development as a Science and Technology Liaison at the EPA office in Seattle in Region 10. Kira has long been an advocate of innovation in Superfund cleanups. She was previously a remedial project manager and is one of the pioneer RPMs conducting footprint evaluations at a Superfund project. And finally, our last speaker is Hillary Thornton, a friend and colleague currently with EPA's Region 3 office in Philadelphia. And Hillary is also one of the co-chairs of the EPA Technology Support Program Engineering Subcommittee, Green Remediation Engineering Subcommittee. In the meeting back in 2009 of the subcommittee, the TSB agreed to take on the task of producing the methodology. I appreciate Hillary's leadership and efforts managing the production and review process of the methodology. Let's move to the next slide, please. Slide number 4. We have structured this webinar in a similar fashion to the August 2011 webinar, when we only had an outline and very rough sections of the methodology. Of course, we now have the final methodology, and we hope to fill in some of the gaps. So the goal of today's seminar is to introduce the EPA methodology for environmental footprint analysis and remediation of projects. I'll provide some background on the methodology and place it in the context of agency policy on greener cleanups, as well as providing an introduction to some of the key concepts in the overall methodology structure. Doug will then walk you through an overview of the methodology and its application in a case study approach. Karen picks up then and highlights some key considerations when interpreting results of a footprint analysis, and provide some tips on how to focus on relevant findings. Kira takes this a step further and walks us through the use of the results in achieving footprint reductions. And finally, Hillary closes with where we are going next with methodology at EPA and shares some information and useful resources with you, including some very recent additions to the Kluwen Green Remediation page. If we could go straight to slide number 6, please. So the bit of background on the methodology, the concept of footprint evaluations started back in 2008. At that time, we were producing a series of fact sheets on best management practices for different types of remediation technologies. And we realized that while important footprint reduction could be achieved implementing BMPs, best management practices, at larger, more complex remedies, we needed a better understanding and quantification of what the environmental footprint was. The concept of a footprint evaluation methodology was included in the Superfund Green Remediation Strategy in 2010, which specifically identifies this effort, the methodology, as one of its action items. The OSWER principles for greener cleanups also provide a broad cross-program policy context for the development of the methodology, including the core elements it is built around, and boundaries and general guidance on the use of the results in for footprint evaluations. In that sense, we can say there has been no significant change in policy in any of the programs with respect to their remedy selection processes. Furthermore, footprint analyses are not required by any of the programs, but if and when they are conducted, this footprint evaluation methodology is EPA's preferred approach. Slide number 7, please. So what is the footprint evaluation methodology? What does it do for us? One of the main goals is to provide common language on environmental footprints so we can better understand each other and communicate in this growing field, and better communicate in this growing field. An important part of this are common metrics and a process to quantify them. The methodology can be considered a roadmap to quantifying an environmental footprint. It was designed to be generally compatible with existing footprinting tools, and we are currently engaged in several efforts to test and document this expectation of the methodology. We have been conducting partial or full footprint analyses at many projects since 2008, and the experience gained at these has been the basis for our development of the methodology. In 2011, in August of 2011, we held a webinar on the conceptual outline and had excellent feedback at that event. In fall of 2011, we released the draft report, the draft approach. And we appreciate the time and effort many of you provided in contributing your comments. The final methodology was released, of course, in March of this year. And now we're having the webinar to walk you through that final document. We go to slide number 7, please. The methodology, call this a methodology protocol, but just a couple more backgrounders there. Based on our pilot projects, we have found that the cost of a footprint analysis generally ranges from $5,000 to about $15,000, which is not an insignificant amount of money, but definitely has to be put in the context of a lot of these remediation projects, which easily run into the millions of dollars. Naturally, the cost of the evaluation is lower if it's done concurrent with other planning and design activities and any best management practice of footprint reduction efforts that are put into place are also less expensive if done earlier and concurrent with other types of activities. The methodology applies to all common remedies at any stage. In other words, it's not specific to design, construction, or operation. On the right-hand side, you see the 6 steps of the methodology, the way it's currently structured, basically setting up goals and scope of analysis, gathering relevant information, and then going through the quantification of materials and waste, water, energy and air, and qualitatively evaluating ecosystem services. There is a reason for the organization. We found that a lot of information, when generated in that sequence, spills into the subsequent core elements of.
Again, this is a reminder, please mute your phone line. It's star 6 to mute your line. We can hear some side conversations. Thank you.
Thanks, Jean. So those are the footprints, and I mean the steps of the footprint, and we'll be going through them as part of this webinar. If we could go to slide number 9, please. This is the just a description of the methodology document itself. Of course, hopefully you'll know that the document is available, the methodology is available at cluin.org/greenremediation. That is its main quote-unquote home, although you'll find it throughout several EPA web pages. The main section of the document is a succinct at just over 40 pages, and it includes the metrics, the footprint methodology itself, considerations for interpreting the footprint, and approaches to reducing the footprint. The appendices, in turn, contain what might be some of the more valuable parts of the methodology, such as conversion factors, tables and data presentation formats, and footprint reduction scenarios where we actually walk through, and 3D material in case of evaluation, footprint evaluations, 3 water evaluations, and 2 energy and air scenarios. The document is available in PDF, and we have not produced hard copies, although, of course, you can download these. The entire document, methodology document, is about 140 pages. Section slide number 10, please. As I mentioned earlier, data collection and management is an important part of a footprint evaluation effort. This diagram on the right is pulled from Appendix B on page 74, and it provides you a bit of an idea of how information flows in the methodology. An important table to know is table B1, which includes all the suggested footprint metrics. And we'll mention it later on, but it's important to note that not all core elements or metrics are relevant to all projects. And there is a protocol for screening out elements that or metrics that may not merit being quantified. And we'll discuss that as part of this webinar. Slide number 11, please. Regarding the methodology applicability, one point is the methodology shares traits with life cycle assessments. Our commercially available LCA applications have functions that are compatible with conducting footprint evaluations. However, the goals are different, and hence there are some important differences. For example, the methodology helps us derive green remediation metrics, but it does not apply an impact assessment of those metrics as would be required in a full MCA, life cycle assessment. Another example are materials and waste metrics, which target on-site use and generation rather than off-site or upstream footprint considerations. This is an example of a significant boundary differences with respect to what would be an LCA. And finally, energy and air emissions have fairly broad boundaries that are more dictated by the need to provide actionable information for a project manager. Question we often get, and this relates to other ongoing efforts related to the general topic of green and sustainable remediation, is whether the methodology considers social and economic factors. The methodology, this footprint evaluation methodology, focuses on environmental footprint of contaminated site remediation project. The social and economic factors are addressed in EPA cleanup programs through other existing processes, such as community involvement requirements at EPA's Superfund redevelopment. initiative and Superfund's redevelop initiative. Slide number 12, please. Here's a quick scan through of the green remediation metrics as we'll be discussing them. You'll see in more detail, but I did want to quickly introduce them. With respect to energy, we have total energy use and total energy voluntarily derived from renewable resources. For air, we have greenhouse gases. We have criteria pollutants, NOx, SOx, and particulate matter, both on-site emissions and total emissions. We have hazardous air pollutants, on-site emissions, and total emissions. For water, look at the on-site water use, including public potable water, its quantity, the source of the water, and the fate of used and treated water. Next slide, please. For materials and waste, we look at refined, including manufactured materials used on site. We quantify the percent from recycled materials. We look at bulk unrefined materials used on site, quantify the percent from recycled materials of that part. And then waste, look at waste, hazardous waste generated on site, non-hazardous waste generated on site, and percent of total waste generated on site that is recycled or reused. Regarding land and ecosystem services affected by site cleanup, we currently limit it to a recommended qualitative evaluation. There's a lot of work going on in this field, and we're still struggling with some in some areas, such as scale and boundary issues. So we'll continue looking at those, but for now, the recommendation is a qualitative evaluation. Go to the next slide, please, number 14, the methodology applicability. The idea behind a footprint evaluation is to provide a quantitative approach to apply what can be known as, is known as the Pareto principle in footprint, environmental footprint reduction. What are the 20% of a system's components that are resulting 80% of the footprint? This information will help project managers better target their efforts in reducing a project's environmental footprint. The methodology, process, and its results are of value for all types of cleanup projects and for all cleanup programs, although we could anticipate that in cleanup programs that have larger projects, its application would probably be more common than for small sites. And as I mentioned earlier, it's applicable throughout the various phases of a cleanup project. With respect to EPA, our goal is to train our technical staff on ways of understanding and reducing environmental footprints, and we've already have a series of internal training events throughout the year. And we'll expect to be conducting footprint analyses at our own sites when and where appropriate. The methodology will also be used by EPA to facilitate the evaluation of environmental footprint studies submitted to or shared with EPA by outside parties. So with that, I hand it over to Doug Sutton, who will be doing the methodology overview.
Great. Thank you very much, Carlos. On slide 15 is just an introductory slide, so we will move on to slide 16. And the first thing that I want to do is just show some of the highlights as they pertain to materials and waste, then water, and then the energy and air sections of the methodology. When it comes to materials and waste, the methodology is really just a straightforward accounting of the materials that are used on site and the waste that is generated on site. And most of this information is just readily available from site documents, whether it's a design, an optimization study, an annual report, those sort of things. And I want to focus on that it is on-site. So when we talk about a refined material, we're talking about the steel or the PVC or the zero-valent iron or the vegetable oil that you are using on a site. It's not the materials, refined or unrefined, that go into the manufacturing process. So it is something that you can easily take into account because you're looking at only the materials that are coming onto your site that you are using directly. And same thing with the waste that is generated on-site. We're focused on the waste that is generated on-site, not the waste that is generated off-site as a result of other activities such as materials manufacturing. And one of the nice things about the methodology is it includes a lot of exhibits, I think about six exhibits, associated with the waste and with materials and waste to help quantify things that are not so easily quantified, like rules of thumb to help you figure out how much steel is in a building or how much of a chemical or material is in a chemical solution. Those are designed to help streamline the process and make it easier and avoid some of the grind that would be associated with a typical footprint analysis. So moving on to slide 17, we talk about the water section, and consistent with what Carlos said earlier, we're not just interested in the quantity of the water that's used, but also where did that water come from, how is it being used, and what is the fate of that water after use. And if you think about this enough, you'll start to realize that the footprint or the water footprint of a remedy really does have a lot to do with all of those factors. Moving on to slide 18, comes the energy and air or the energy and emission highlights. And this part of the process is a lot more complex than the others. It's not just a simple accounting because there's a lot of steps to go through to derive these numbers. And there's a three-step process for the most part. It's inventorying the remedy materials or services that are part of the remedy. And once you have those, calculating out your electricity and your fuel use. And then once you have that information, converting your electricity, your fuels, your materials, your off-site services, all those things, into the air, energy and air metrics. And I want to just emphasize that materials are included in a couple places in this methodology. They are part of the materials metrics themselves. But the energy and CO2 and NOx and SOx, all those energy and emissions embodied in the materials are also considered in the energy and emissions metrics as well. Now, the calculations for these items, the energy and emissions, are organized into four categories: on-site, electricity generation, transportation, and then other off-site materials and services. And we did this for a couple reasons. Number one is we wanted to be somewhat parallel with the structure in the Executive Order 13514, which many of you may be familiar with. And we also thought that it was helpful to divide it into these categories because it helps the user get a better understanding of what the big contributors are to the overall footprint. Now, consistent with the other sections, the energy and air also have many exhibits that help in estimating and calculating values, such as the electricity usage of a motor that's on a variable frequency drive. It helps determine the appropriate level of detail by including a screening approach and provides reference footprint conversion factors so that you can convert your materials and other known activities into the energy and air emissions or energy and air metrics. So moving on to slide 19, Carlos already mentioned the seven steps associated with the methodology, and we're going to go through an application of the methodology. And I just wanted to remind you of those seven steps before we do that, starting off with setting goals and the scope of the analysis, and then ending with presenting the results. And I'll flag each of these steps as we move through the application or the example application. So moving on to slide 20, which is a placeholder slide or introduction slide. We'll move on to slide 21, where we talk about our example application. For this application, we have a pump and treat system that's designed to treat arsenic and operate for 30 years using co-precipitation, which is a chemically intensive and a process and also results in substantial waste generation. The water is discharged to a creek. The electricity in the area is assumed to be close to that of California. The remedy is in the design stage, and the reason we are doing the analysis is to help identify green remediation practices to be included in the system design. So moving on to slide 22, the first step is to set our goals and the scope of the analysis. Now, I already said that the purpose of doing this analysis was to identify green remediation practices during design. If we move to slide 23, we can look at the scope of the analysis. We're looking at the construction of the system, so the footprint associated with the construction, the O&M of the system, and also the performance monitoring. Of course, in a different study, we might choose to only focus on construction or only focus on O&M, so it's important to specify what exactly you are studying. We're only looking at the groundwater remedy. There might also be a soil remedy at the site or a sediment remedy or any other types of remedies at the site, and it's also important to clarify that you're only focused on the aspects that you're studying. And then we're assuming that the system here will be used for other purposes, maybe transported somewhere else for use, at the conclusion of the remedy such that, you know, we don't need to consider the demobilization or the deconstruction and demolition of the facility. The study boundary, you know, whether or not we're including infrastructure or how far back we're taking our calculations, is really established by the EPA methodology, so there's not a lot to be said there in addition to that. And the functional unit of the analysis for the life cycle assessment people out there, we're the numbers that we'll be calculating here are associated with the remedy life cycle from construction through operation. Another study or another group might choose to look at the numbers on an annual basis of operation or to look at the numbers per gallon treated or per pound removed. You can set up any number of functional units. In this particular case, we're looking at the remedy life cycle. So moving on to slide 24. It's an introduction slide for step two, which is gather the remedy information. And slide 25, this is the kind of information that you would typically have readily available in site documents. Things like the number, depth, and design of extraction wells, the length and size of the piping, the extraction rate you're expecting, the size of your treatment plant, the information, you know, pumps, mixtures, all those other things that might go into estimating electricity use. The information you use for generating waste, for waste generation or chemical use, what your monitoring program looks like, those sorts of things. The other information that needs to be gathered is transportation distances, and this is one of those types of or pieces of information that is very useful in a footprint analysis, but is not typically part of our traditional site documents. We might say that we might name the vendor, usually we don't, in a design document as to where we're getting a chemical or a material. We typically don't even mention the vendor, but we certainly don't ever mention how far that stuff is coming from and how much it's going to take to transport it to the site. So that's something that is a piece of information that you'll need that is not something that you're typically used to gathering. Slide number 26. We talk about screening limits. So the point about gathering information is also to figure out what should be included and what is negligible and can be excluded. Certainly, we could all drive ourselves crazy footprinting looking at the impacts associated with paper clips and pencil erasers, but that wouldn't do us much good. So the idea of the screening process is to help us identify and document what we're including and what we're excluding from the analysis. It's not a hard and fast rule. It's just there to help streamline the process. And it's also heavily based on professional judgment. Now, the idea behind the screening process is to set up two different types of limits, one that's a kind of a percentage-based limit and one that's a magnitude-based limit. The percentage-based limit would be something like, well, if I know my largest contributor to this type of footprint, then I want to exclude everything that's smaller than 1% or 10% or whatever number you deem to be appropriate based on your professional judgment. We typically use 1%. To say that anything below 1% of that contribution should be considered negligible and I don't need to worry about it. The magnitude-based limit is something you can just set to say, well, I think anything above this should be included and anything below it should be excluded. So if we look at the table here, and we can do the metric over on the side, we do the screening process for any number of metrics, including the refined materials all the way down to total energy use. Looking at the first row, refined materials in units of tons, we, based on our professional judgment at this stage, think that the sodium hydroxide that we'll be adding is the largest contribution to the materials use over the 30 years of operation. Our engineering estimates assume that it's about 3,100 tons of sodium hydroxide that will be used. If we use a 1% screening level here, that would be 31 tons. And certainly we'd think that anything over 1 ton would be important. So if we compare those two units, 31 tons, anything over 31 tons we believe should be included in the materials footprint. And anything below 31 tons, we'd have reason to exclude it if we wanted to. And you can go down the line here and see that we've set up screening limits for each of these different components. If you go down far enough and look at total energy use, you'll see units of SU. Those are screening units, and we can talk about those more later. But certainly having these screening limits assigned will help you document what you think is important to include and what is negligible and can be excluded. So moving on to slide 27, if you're going through a screening process, you're likely going to end up with items that get excluded. and it's very helpful to list examples of those items that are excluded. I wouldn't want to say that you want to list everything that you're not excluding, because then you would be talking about paper clips and pencils. So we want to at least provide some examples. In this particular case, it turns out that the piping, the well casing and the grout, the valves and the fittings, and the process equipment and controls are all small relative, all less than 1% compared to the materials that are compared to the sodium hydroxide that we anticipate using. Similarly, when we get down to the unrefined materials, turns out that the sand used in the well construction is also negligible relative to some of the other materials, unrefined materials we're using at the site. Looking at waste, and you might be able to expect this, used sampling equipment, used gloves, packaging, things like that are going to be insignificant relative to some of the other components we're looking at. So those are just an example of documenting the types of things that you'd be excluding from the analysis. In this particular example, of course, this might change for a different study, a different system, a different remedy. Moving on to slide 28, we can now start moving into step three, which is quantifying the various metrics. We'll move on to slide 29. And this table here is the process by which we document the refined materials usage, the refined materials metrics. This table is pretty much lifted from the methodology with some color coding just for presentation purposes. The left three columns are things, you know, the light shading is information that the user would put into the methodology. The middle two kind of moderately shaded columns is information that you can obtain from the methodology itself. It's in exhibits or in the body of the text. And then the last two columns over on the right, the heavily shaded columns, are calculated values that you calculate yourself based on the other information. So if we look at the first row, just as an example, building steel, units of cubic feet, quantity 240,000 cubic feet. Conversion to pounds, 1 pound per cubic foot, 55% of that is recycled or anticipated to be recycled material. And there's your results in terms of recycled and virgin material associated with that building steel. Now, a lot of you might point out that 1 pound per cubic foot is ridiculously low as for a density of steel, and you're correct. But I wanted to highlight this because the this conversion factor actually comes from one of the exhibits in the methodology where you can provide the volume of the building and get out of that using a rule of thumb the estimated amount of steel in the building. So rather than having to go through and figure out how much steel is actually in the building construction itself, especially if at an early stage of the project and you don't know what that is, you can use this rule of thumb to translate that building volume into the amount of steel. And I think that greatly simplifies the process for a lot of studies. It certainly, we wouldn't prevent you from or discourage you from getting more specific information from a vendor, but at least that rule of thumb is there to assist with streamlining the analysis. So if we look down the bottom where the red boxes, those are actually the results of the refined materials footprint or metric. The 15,340,500 pounds, actually that should probably be in tons instead of pounds to be consistent with the methodology, but that's the value of the material, refined materials footprint, and then less than 1% of that happens to be from recycled or reused content. Moving on to slide 30, we are looking at the unrefined materials, and it's such a similar process that I think we'll skip talking about that for now. It's very similar to what we just talked about, so it would be a little bit redundant. It's just for unrefined materials such as soil or concrete or soil or sand or fill, that type of thing. Moving on to slide 31, we look at waste. And again, just a straightforward accounting. The upper half of this table is for identifying those potential wastes that you were able to recycle or reuse. And the lower half of the table are those wastes that you ended up having to dispose of, whether by landfill, incineration, what have you. And in this particular example, we have 7,800 tons of sludge that is being disposed of as hazardous waste, 0 tons that's being disposed of as non-hazardous waste. And so those are both metrics that we've calculated now. And because we weren't able to recycle anything, 0% of our potential waste is recycled. That's another metric result. So moving on to slide 32, We can now move into step four, which is to look at the on-site water metrics. And we'll jump into slide 33. And this table, consistent with what I told you before and what Carlos mentions, that we're looking at the source of the water, the quantity of the water, the use of the water, and the fate of the water. And the left-hand column talks about the various water resources, public water supply, you know, extracted groundwater from the shallow aquifer, surface water, et cetera. Then we have a description of the public water supply. That water is potable. How much of it that we use? 360 million, because the 360 million gallons, because the units are in thousands of gallons. We use it for blending the polymer associated with the treatment process, and ultimately the major discharge location is the creek. We also have groundwater that we're extracting as part of this pump and treat system from the shallow aquifer. It's of marginal quality, and you might want to put a little bit more detail in there. Maybe it has high total dissolved solids because of some high iron levels. We're extracting 11 billion gallons over time, treating it and discharging it to the creek. You can see that this provides you provides a stakeholder, whoever is reviewing the methodology, a little bit more of an idea of what the water is being used for and what the water footprint actually is by providing them some of this fate. I mean, one would argue that extraction of shallow groundwater, treating and discharging into the creek really does not upset the water balance at the site. But if we move on to slide 34, you can see that this is just an alternate scenario. What if it was the same exact scenario, except for rather than extracting water from a shallow aquifer with marginal quality, we were extracting it from, say, the Ogallala Aquifer, and it was a vital aquifer with potentially potable water. We're extracting all of the 11 billion gallons and discharging it to a creek, and it's hightailing its way out of the watershed relatively quickly. That would be a much different water footprint than the previous example I just showed you, which is why we try to look at the source, use, and fate in addition to just the quantity of water used. Moving on to slide 5, we can transition into looking at the energy and air metrics, and we'll go on to slide 36. We revisit the screening process here. And if we were to look back at our previous slides, we identified a screening limit for energy as 390,000 screening units. So anything more than 390,000 screening units would have merit to be included in the analysis, and anything below it we'd have a reason to exclude if we wanted to. And so you might ask, what's a screening unit and how do I figure that out? The methodology includes a fairly extensive table of common practices such as drilling, excavation, waste disposal, electricity use, materials use, transportation, personnel transportation, materials transportation, et cetera, and how many screening units are in a kind of a common quantity to those things. So it's a pretty simple way of taking something that you know, maybe drilling and drilling of wells and numbers of feet, and converting that into screening units. Now, once you have those screening units, you can compare them to your limit, in this case, which is 390,000. So if we look at the top row, well installation, we know we're drilling less than 1,000 feet. Pretty easy to estimate that. The screening unit table I told you would help us convert that into 50,000, something less than 50,000 screening units, which is clearly less than our 390,000 limit, which means that this can certainly be excluded from the analysis, at least in as far as the energy and carbon footprint metrics are concerned. When you look at the electrical equipment for 30 years, that's a very large number, and it's actually the one that was the basis of our screening limit to begin with, so that's certainly going to be included at 39 million. Let's see if we can find another decent example down here. Miles of personnel transport over 30 years. So in this case, from a professional judgment point of view, it might be easy to say that, you know, I estimate that this is going to be less than 500,000 miles of personnel transport over the course of the remedy. That translates to less than 250,000 screening units. So, you know, less than 200,000 screening units, that's less than the 390,000. We're well below 1% of the largest contributor. So, you know, I don't have to call all the operators and find out how close or far they live from the treatment plant. I don't have to figure out how many trips we're making. I don't have to worry about those extra trips we might make for the five-year review. I don't have to worry about alarm calls. Something that might be a pretty laborious process to figure out personnel transport miles in this particular instance, you've learned that it's a fairly minor contributor and may not be worthwhile including in the overall footprint analysis. That being said, it's not something you just want to ignore. It might be a good target for applying best management practices like using low-emission vehicles or carpooling or things like that. Looking at the building and concrete reinforcing steel, that one comes in at 292,000 pounds, which translates to 292,000 screening units. Well, that's below our target, so you could certainly exclude it. But we already went through the process of calculating that for the materials footprint. The information is already readily available, so there's really not much harm in including that in the analysis. After all, the screening process is not a hard and fast rule. It's just there to help us figure out and document what can be included and what does not need to be included. But since this information is available, why not include it? So moving on to slide number 37. Once we have what's going to be included, we can now start to translate things like electricity or electrical equipment into electricity usage. We can translate things like natural gas equipment into natural gas usage, and things like transportation and heavy equipment into fuel usage. And you can see here in this particular example, last row, our fuel use for materials transportation turns out to be close to 500,000 gallons of diesel. And if we move to the next slide, number 38, once we have that, we can now start to actually calculate the energy and the emissions footprint or metrics. So the electricity, we'd multiply that by electricity conversion factors.
Yeah.
We'd take the fuel combustion, such as your diesel or your gasoline, and apply our conversion factors for the fuel use. The materials, we'd apply those emission or those conversion factors and any other services associated. We add them all up together, and in this case, we have our carbon footprint, or carbon metric.
Yeah.
Of course, we'd apply the same sort of thing for other types of emissions and energy use.
Doug, I'm sorry to bother you, but this is just a reminder. If you're having a side conversation, we can hear you. I'd ask that you please place your phone on mute, hitting star 6. And the gentleman who's speaking right now, again, we can hear you. It's star 6 if you can mute your phone line.
Paul Parkinson, thanks, here.
So I will now try to speak louder, Gene.
Thanks. And if that doesn't work, we'll globally mute everyone. But
okay.
Thanks.
So slide number 39, it just gives another outline of the type of information or how it gets calculated. It's not an exact table pulled from the methodology just for presentation purposes, but you can see on slide 39 that we have the first column. We've categorized things or broken things out to on-site versus electricity generation versus transportation and versus off-site. We have the different components that are included in those, the quantities and familiar units like kilowatt hours or gallons used, and then the calculation of the energy footprint in millions of BTUs, the calculation of the carbon footprint in tons, and then I left off on the screenshot the NOx, SOx, and PM or the hazardous air pollutants on-site or off-site from the analysis just for space-saving purposes with the presentation, but typically, the methodology would include columns for that. And you can see the numbers down at the bottom, the magnitudes of those numbers for this example. So moving on to slide 40, we get to the ecosystem services, step 6, which Carlos mentioned before. We're looking at qualitative analyses or qualitative descriptions now at this point. And if we move on to slide number 41, we can start talking about results. Skip on to slide number 42. And the footprint table, I actually probably should have updated this a little bit more to be more of an exact replicate of what is in the methodology itself. But ultimately, it's a pretty good representation of the kinds of numbers you're going to get. You're going to end up with a table somewhat similar to this that has a bunch of numbers in it. And those numbers are going to represent all the work that you just did in the past 6 steps. And some of those numbers might be really big, and some of them might be really small. And the question then becomes, well, what do these all mean, and what do I do with these numbers? And that is where I get to hand off the discussion to Karen and Kira. So, Karen, if you would like to pick up on slide 43.
Thanks, Doug.
So Doug just showed in his final slide the results from the footprint analysis for a case study showing a lot of numbers. And he brought up the question of how should we interpret those results? And we're in slide 43 now. And so that's what I'll be talking about here, key considerations for interpreting the results of the footprint analysis. And I'll point out considerations to take into account not only after the analysis is completed, but also during the footprint analysis. So now we're on slide 44. And so as you get underway with the footprint analysis, you'll begin refining your approach. And one question that you'll want to ask is what activities or materials can be omitted from the analysis? And that was what Doug was just talking about in terms of the screening. And when you notice materials that you use in small amounts and activities occurring at infrequent intervals, you will identify those to be minimal contributors to the footprint, and you may be able to omit them from the formal analysis. And as Doug was showing, this methodology suggests the process for screening those minor contributors. And another question that you'll be asking as you go through the footprint analysis is, what are the sources of error or uncertainty in the analysis? For example, at the preliminary design stage, your remedy design may show 10 extraction wells, but you may be aware that the final design could require more wells than that. And you may identify other sources of uncertainty, such as remedy timeframes or footprint conversion factors. As the footprint analysis progresses, you'll want to address these types of uncertainties, for example, by evaluating alternative remedy designs, performing sensitivity analyses, or conducting additional research. Now, the methodology will help you think through these types of questions. And the key message here is that you should document the items screened out of the analysis, as Doug mentioned earlier, and you should document the sources of uncertainty as you proceed with the analysis. Moving to slide 45. Now, these are some questions to ask after the footprint analysis is completed. And these questions pertain to understanding, interpreting, and applying the results from the footprint analysis. So I'll be touching on each of these in a separate slide. We're talking about how accurate are the results, what is the big footprint, what parameters are of greatest importance, and can I use the results of a footprint analysis to target areas for improvement? So moving on to slide 46. So beginning with how accurate are the results. During the footprint analysis, as I mentioned earlier, you will have documented sources of uncertainty. So you can keep this in mind as you interpret the results. So for example, regarding uncertainties in scope, the pump and treat remedy in our case study was expected to continue for 30 years, but if this is only an approximate time frame, you would have identified that fact during the analysis, and now while you're interpreting the final results, you would keep that in mind and interpret the results accordingly. Also, uncertainties in major contributors to the footprint. We know that in our case study, some of the major contributors to greenhouse gas emissions are electricity use, chemical use, and natural gas for heating the buildings. So we need to be aware of any assumptions or uncertainties in data inputs for these particular items, these big contributors, such as usage rates of those items and the footprint conversion factors that we're using in our footprint analysis for those items. And the bottom line is, when interpreting and applying the results of a footprint analysis, keep in mind that the results of the analysis are estimates to help guide future footprint reductions, and they are not exact numbers. Moving now on to slide 47, the question of what is a big footprint? In our case study, we estimated greenhouse gas emissions at about 45,000 tons. And we estimate on-site water usage at 360 million gallons. And we also estimated that there would be about 8,000 tons of hazardous waste generated. Now, these numbers sound big, but what is a good benchmark for comparison? And how do we know whether these are too big, in quotes and unquote? Are they too big, and should they be reduced? Well, there are no universal benchmarks for footprints from our site cleanups. Our perception of big or small may be dependent on the size of the site and the effort required for cleanup. However, you can think about this in certain ways. You can look at the size of the footprint from a particular remedy and how it compares with the footprints of similar remedies in your organization's portfolio, or you can see how it compares with your organization's overall footprint. And there also may be goals for footprint reductions that your organization has set for itself. Of course, we should keep in mind that even a small percentage reduction of the footprint from a site cleanup may translate to a large reduction in magnitude, and we should try to make those reductions wherever it seems to make sense. Slide 48. So moving on to the question of what parameters are of the greatest importance. As you saw, the methodology recommends a fairly large array of metrics in four of EPA's core elements of green remediation. But once you see the results of a footprint analysis, how can you tell which of the parameters, which of the metrics are of the greatest importance? Now, this will depend on conditions specific to the site and also on the values that are important to the site stakeholders. So, for example, in our case study, if our site is in a region of non-attainment for particulates, then particulate emissions may be of greatest concern to the stakeholders. Also, for a municipality with greenhouse gas reduction goals, greenhouse gas emissions may be an important or the most important consideration. And the water footprint may be important in a site that's in arid lands. And as another example, waste generation may be important for a community with concerns regarding landfill space. So we should be aware that depending on what site and where it's located, the metrics of most importance may be different from one site to the other. And of course, we should also be aware that there may be trade-offs among the various metrics at any one site in our footprint analysis. Moving on to slide 49. So finishing up with this slide on using the results to target areas of improvement. So if the question is, can I use the results to target areas of improvement? Of course, the answer is a big yes. A footprint analysis can provide results in a format that highlights the key contributors, as shown in this chart. This is one example of how you could visually represent the results and the key contributors. And this chart shows the estimated greenhouse gas emissions from all the activities and materials required for the remedy in our case study. Now, often we focus on reducing our usage of gasoline, diesel fuel, and electricity to reduce our carbon footprint. And this is always a good idea, but in many cases, such as the one illustrated here for our case study, there may be other activities that make substantial contributions to the footprint. And here, as you can see from that tall bar, electricity generation is the largest contributor, but we can also see that there are other relatively significant contributors, such as natural gas usage for heating the buildings associated with the remedy, and production of chemical reagents such as ferric chloride and sodium hydroxide. So these are also key contributors that we would want to check in on if we wanted to reduce our footprint. The key contributors to the footprint will be different for each new site. So if we made the same sort of chart for a different site, different technology, different location, we may come up or almost certainly would come up with different key contributors. Perhaps electricity would be very low and something like carbon regeneration or granular activated carbon would be very high. So it really is site specific and location specific. We have found in case studies and pilot studies and other sites where we've run footprint analysis that we've seen key contributors such as production of bioremediation nutrients, production of zero-valent iron have been key contributors. Also, wastewater treatment and laboratory analyses conducted off-site, those have been key contributors at other sites, as well as things like landfilling of waste and, as I mentioned before, regeneration of granular activated carbon can be sometimes seen as key contributors at certain sites. So to wrap up, this chart demonstrates one of the primary benefits of conducting a footprint analysis. That is a way to see what are your key contributors and then giving you the ability to target those key contributors for footprint reduction. So this can serve as a lead in to our next speaker, Kira, who will talk about using the results of a footprint analysis.
Thanks, Karen. So I'm going to go ahead and go on to slide 51. And as Karen has already mentioned to you, you know, this slide just highlights the main goal as far as the interpreting the results from the output of the methodology is to be able to identify those factors that are really contributing to your overall environmental footprint and looking at options for either changing the approach or other factors that can reduce that footprint. So going on to slide number 52, one of the things that we like to point out is that, you know, everything that we're talking about today as far as actions that could be taken to reduce our overall environmental footprint of any of the remedial actions that we're taking is completely consistent with good science and engineering and all of the concepts that we have tried to promote in the past in regards to optimizing our remedial designs and really looking at efficiencies in the way that we're designing and remediating sites. So for example, if you have a site where there are opportunities, for example, of reducing the total area that you're targeting for source treatment, that by reducing the total area that you're targeting for source treatment, you're also reducing the energy required for treating a larger area that may not need to be treated. So by optimizing where you're targeting and looking for source treatment, you're also optimizing and reducing your overall footprint of your environmental remedy. So many of the concepts that we're talking about today are completely consistent with the concept of optimization or good science and engineering to really be able to look at efficiently remediating our environmental problems. So going on to slide number 53, this slide just kind of highlights the steps that we've identified for the methodology. We have the process that we go through to identify some of the big contributors and then looking at ways to optimize our remedy design, maybe reduce the footprint of some of those large contributors. We also have just standard things that we can consider, like you've heard some of the other speakers mention, that are considered like best management practices, things like recycling materials on site and using biofuels and other things that should be just standard practices that all of us are incorporating into all of the actions that we're taking, because they may have smaller incremental impacts, but they can add on to some of the larger changes that we can make to reduce the overall environmental footprint. And then we also have another factor that can be considered even above and beyond those two, which is applying renewable energy to the actual action that's being taken. Going on to slide number 54, this is just an example of looking at a pump and treat system and the output from the environmental methodology and looking at how changing certain factors with that remedy can change the overall environmental footprint in regards to looking at CO2 emitted. So what you're seeing here on this bar chart is on version one. That's the total CO2 emitted considering use of a granular activated carbon treatment system with discharge to a sanitary sewer, where if you're looking at the second option, which would be also having the same pump and treat system, but looking at using air stripping as opposed to granular activated carbon and eliminating the waste associated with the GAC. Version 3 is looking at using the air stripper as opposed to the GAC, but then also discharging to surface water as opposed to discharging to the sanitary sewer and reducing the footprint even further. And then finally, version 4 is looking at all of the factors that we included in version 3, but then putting on top of that the use of renewable energy. So going on to slide number 55, this is another example of modifying factors within a remedy and how that can input or impact your overall environmental footprint for both CO2 and your potable water. So looking at version one, that would be using an injection of emulsified vegetable oil and a potable water source to inject that material. Version two is using the same emulsified vegetable oil, but then using extracted water, so not having to have any impact on the potable water supply at all. Version three is using a biodiesel, so you have a small reduction in both the CO2 and the potable water. And version four here is if you were to use an off-spec waste food grade product as your carbon amendment for the enhanced bio as opposed to using something like an emulsified vegetable oil. And we have found through the analysis that we've done, for example, that if you can find a food grade waste product, that is really a way to significantly reduce your overall environmental footprint because you're reusing a material that would be considered a waste. Some of the other versions here, version five would be, if this is just an example, if you would be able to look at reducing the total area that you were targeting for the bioremediation and as such reducing both the amount of amendment that you had to use as well as the amount of potable water that or whatever water would be required for that. And then finally, the version six is doing the same thing, but also looking at using the off-spec nutrient. And then finally, version seven is looking at all of the various factors that we had considered in the other examples that result in the lowest environmental footprint. And you can see there that we've basically almost completely eliminated the impact as far as the CO2 and have significantly reduced the impact on the water usage. So going on to slide number 56, one of the outputs of the methodology will allow you to break down the various factors within your remedy and be able to figure out what the big contributors are. So the table here on slide number 56 is just an example from the pump and treat system where we have various footprint parameters and we have identified within that table the factors, the primary contributors that are contributing towards that footprint parameter. So for example, with public water use, the main contributor to that is the polymer blending in the pump and treat system.
Kira, I'm sorry, before you go on, I just want to remind someone to please mute their phone line. We can hear clicks and beeps and tones in the background. So if you haven't done so, please mute your phone line by using the star six command. Thank you.
Thanks, Jean. Going on to slide number 57, once you've identified what what the big contributors are. The next step is to break those down into the various contributors and look at the factors that are feeding into those contributors so you can look at ways to reduce those overall impacts. So, for example, with the electricity, that's primarily being influenced by the building lighting and the HVAC and the extraction rate. And the extraction rate is being influenced by the types of pumps and mixer motors. So, for example, would there be a way of maybe changing the types of pumps or mixers that are being used to reduce that overall impact? So really that's what the methodology allows you to do, is to break down the system and look at the various components and be able to backtrack and say, are there things that I could change or I could modify that could really allow me to reduce the overall environmental footprint? Going on to slide number 58. So these are just some examples of ways that we can address some of the big contributors. I think we've already discussed a little bit about the contributors that are related to the site conceptual model. So, and this is definitely an area where there can be significant reductions. For example, if we look at the remedy and say, is there a way that we can optimize the extraction rate, or is there a way that we can look at additional force removal for the site and as a result optimize the amount of overall energy that's going to be required to be able to meet our end goals for the project. There's also opportunities to look at kind of standard process optimization. So, for example, would there be different types of components that we could use, or different types of chemicals that we could use, or even with the example of In-Situ Bio, can we use an off-spec material as the amendment as opposed to using a primary compound and as such reduce the overall environmental footprint? There's also simple things like, can we change the size of motors or pumps so that we're not over-designing and as such using more energy-intensive equipment than what we really need. Going on now to slide number 59. Some of the other contributors, we can look at kind of traditional energy efficiency, things like can we adjust the building HVAC or the lighting operation? Can we use more efficient lighting technologies? There's opportunities for looking at ways that we could manage our waste stream and reduce the waste stream, or use chemicals that have less of a significant environmental footprint. And then finally, you know, we don't want to lose track of all of the smaller best management practices that we can be using, and also the concept of using on-site renewable energy, both as opportunities to even reduce our environmental footprint even more above and beyond specific changes that we can look at on each site. So finally, going on to slide number 60. This slide just highlights once again that our focus on the methodology when we've talked with you has really been on kind of identifying these big contributors and looking at changes that we can make there. But we're also not trying to de-emphasize the fact that we all recognize that the small contributors really add up on all of our sites. And we're definitely encouraging all of the project managers at a minimum to be using kind of the best management practices for environmental footprint reduction across all of our sites, and considering things like carpooling and taking waste to local facilities and recycling, things that we can do just standard on all of our sites. So that's the end of my presentation. I think I'm turning it over to Hillary now. Thank you.
Thank you, Kira. So moving on to slide 61, I'm Hillary Thornton. I'll tell you a little bit about the next steps for the environmental footprint methodology. slide 62. We have a number of initiatives going on for training and technology transfer for the environmental footprint methodology. Today's webinar is an example in the upper right-hand corner of training via internet seminars through cluein.org. We also have, for EPA staff, a number of in-house training opportunities in 2012. We have a train the trainer session at our TSP meeting coming up in Oklahoma City on May 2nd. We have training at EPA Region 9 on May 16th. And future regional training sessions will be planned as budget and travel permit. We have one we're working to put together in Region 5, for example. At the National Association of Remedial Project Managers training in October of this year, we will have a four-hour session on the methodology that will expand on what you've seen in the webinar today and include some practical examples, let folks work through some of the calculations and see how things can be applied a little bit more. Speaking of applications, we have additional example applications and case studies posted on cluein.org/green remediation, the URL in the lower right-hand corner of slide 62. Next slide, slide 63, tools and support that EPA has produced. EPA has today released footprint spreadsheets that we are starting to use that are consistent with the final methodology. They're posted at the website listed there, cluein.org/green remediation. Use of these spreadsheets is optional. We hope that they're fairly self-explanatory, but we do provide you with a warning that they don't come with a user manual or technical support. You need to be able to work through the use of a multi-part spreadsheet on your own. We do advise folks outside of the agency interested in using or adapting these workbooks to consider obtaining technical assistance from qualified environmental or engineering professionals. EPA's green remediation coordinators and EPA's engineering forum staff will be points of contact available to answer questions regarding the methodology for those folks within EPA. Moving on to slide 64, what about other tools beyond those of the spreadsheets for environmental footprint analysis that EPA has developed? Well, there are also a number of tools developed by other organizations, including some that have been developed using federal funding, such as SiteWise and the Sustainable Remediation Tool. There are also a number of commercial life cycle assessment tools available out on the market, as well as a number of proprietary tools for environmental footprinting that have been developed by various consulting firms. These tools have not been evaluated by EPA, and they may have varying degrees of consistency with the methodology. EPA doesn't plan to endorse individual tools, but we do want you to be aware that other tools like these do exist. And you may experience the product of some of these other footprinting tools as various folks use them and may present them to you for review. So moving on to slide 65, there are a number of other green remediation, greener cleanup resources and tools out there. Once again, at the bottom of the screen, cluein.org/green remediation. That's your one-stop shop for all of this information that I'm describing on this slide. And you've got the website itself, best management practices toolkit, your contracting toolkit with clauses and various contracting options there for including this into your project. There are footprint evaluation tools and examples. You want to see where has an environmental footprint been applied before and read some of that material that is posted there. There are 30 site profiles where green remediation or greener cleanup has been applied at sites through the various cleanup programs, and profiles have been written up and posted there. Sometimes a few pictures and a description are very valuable in helping to see what might be usable by you at your sites or projects. The EPA headquarters and all 10 regional policies are on there, as well as strategies. And there's news, training, and information about upcoming conferences as well. So there's a tremendous amount of resources available for you to apply the environmental footprint methodology at your sites. And if you do apply it, please let us know, and we can add your site on there as a new profile. Thank you. With that, that completes my next steps portion of the presentation. I'm going to turn things back over to Carlos Pachon to moderate any questions that may have come in. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Hillary. Can you hear me?
We can.
Great. Thanks, Gene. Thanks, everybody, for those presentations. I appreciate it. Looks like we do have some interest, a good bundle of questions on the Internet, and we've reserved 40 minutes for discussion. I'm glad we did that. Let me first see if there's a phone on from the participants on the phone lines. If you could please take your phone off mute, identify yourself, ask a question, and if you know specifically who would like to answer it, go ahead and identify them. So,
remember,
questions?
It's pound six. It's pound six if you need to unmute your phone lines.
Hey, Carlos, this is Paul Favara.
Hi, Paul.
Hi. Earlier in the presentation, I think you bracketed the cost at about $5,000 to $15,000. I was wondering if you or one of your team members could maybe break that down into maybe a percent that might be associated with gathering the information, interpreting the results, and then the reporting aspect of it, just to provide a little more context on how that work might be distributed.
Okay, I'll check with Karen and let Karen and Doug address that one. Though certainly, the data collection part is one of the more resource-intensive ones, and that did not factor that much in-house. In other words, the final decision-making process of how to use the information, it's more generating the actual footprint quantification. But Karen or Doug, would you either care to take a jab at that one?
This is
Karen. I'll go ahead, and Doug, then maybe you can chime in. To me, I see it really depending site by site. Because if you have, let's say you're an EPA staff person and you have a contractor working on your footprint analysis, if the contractor is already familiar with that site and has been doing all of the other work at that site, then the data collection part would be relatively minor because that individual has knowledge of the site. If it's a site where a contractor is coming in separately and seeing the site for the first time, then the data collection could be a large portion. But I would kind of just say, on average, in general, I could see it be just kind of one-third, one-third, one-third. About one-third of one's time would be in data collection. Maybe another third of the time would be running the footprint evaluation itself, and then another third interpreting the results and applying the results. Doug, anything you want to change or add to that?
Yeah, I think, we all have different perspectives. I think she's right in terms of saying it really depends on the site and the familiarity with the project. But I'd say that for my typical experience is that I might say 40% is information gathering, you know, really using really rough averages, recognizing these can change anyway. I'd say probably 40% is is or more is information gathering, 40% or more is reporting, and less than 20% is actually using the tool. I mean, the tool, and whether that tool is the spreadsheets that I use when I do EPA studies, or whether it's some of the other tools that Hillary mentioned, they're all pretty straightforward to use. It's more or less just data entry. The trick is figuring out what data to enter. And it's one of the main reasons why we put the screening process into the methodology, was to try to help people avoid the trap of collecting more and more and more information than you need to, and then also having to document and report on more and more and more information than you need to. So I'd say that overall the process is overwhelmingly information gathering and reporting, and not so much actual spreadsheet or tool use, unless you're running through many, many different scenarios trying to figure out how to tweak things one way or another or analyze results.
Yeah, and Doug, this is Kara. I'd like to add one thing to that. It goes along with something that I had said in my presentation, which is, we're really encouraging people to incorporate this into their standard process for looking at a remedy selection or remedy design, and this shouldn't be something that's above and beyond what you would be doing as part of your standard remedy evaluation or design process. It's really good science and engineering, and it should be incorporated in as far as part of that process.
Great. Thanks for the question, Paul. Appreciate it. I'm going to take one of the questions from the internet that may have been answered already, but let me maybe we can expand on it a little bit. It's from Zach Schreiber, New York City Office of Environmental Remediation. Question is there no explicit consideration of stormwater in the water metrics?
Carlos, there is mention of stormwater in the water metrics, particularly as it can be captured and used in some way, shape, or form. So if you're if your remedy involves diverting stormwater from its otherwise intended purpose, such as infiltrating in the ground and replenishing an aquifer, the methodology does consider that used water if you're diverting it somewhere else. So you ideally what you would do is you'd put in your metrics in your water metric table something along the lines of how much stormwater you think is being diverted, where it's being diverted to, et cetera, so that can be noted in that table. Absolutely.
And let me note that additionally of the BMPs we recognize, identify, list, et cetera, associated with the different remedies, effective stormwater management to reduce turbidity, sedimentation, nutrient loading, et cetera, is definitely one of the top ones. But it was not factored into the footprint methodology in that way. So thank you. We have a more specific question here. This is from William Weber and from AMEC in Portland, Maine. The sodium hydroxide used in 27 is the life cycle or annual amount?
That's the old life cycle. That was the life cycle number.
Okay, thank you.
Just to clarify, it was a life cycle number in gallons that was then translated into actual pure or kind of bulk Na, sodium hydroxide, so sodium hydroxide salt over the lifetime.
So again, if you're on the phone lines, you'd like to ask a question, please take your phone off mute and identify yourself.
Carlos?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Jerry Vorak at URS. And,
yes, how are you doing?
Okay, I just have a quick question on page 18. You mentioned about the executive order 13514. I was just wondering where we could get a copy of that.
Search for executive order 13514 on any search engine. It should pop up pretty quickly, I think. I downloaded it a few years ago, so I haven't had to go look for it recently. But I would think it'd come up on a pretty quick web search.
Okay. Yeah, you'll definitely find it. A lot of federal agencies, Department of Defense and others, it's a lot of their GSR practices are based on it. So it's pretty widespread right now.
Yeah, it's based out of the whitehouse.gov website.
Okay. Other question on the phone lines, please?
Doug? This is Josh Van Boger with the Corps of Engineers, Louisville District.
Yes.
Got a question. Can you go back to slide 36 where you were talking about the inventory and the screening?
Yes.
I was a little unclear on how you got from those quantities in the third column that have different units to the energy screening units column and what units those screening units are.
Yeah, you know, it's I mentioned it very briefly verbally, but there's an exhibit in the methodology, and I will point to the exhibit number in a second. Let me just identify it. I think it's exhibit number 3.2 on page 47 of the methodology document. Includes a table that has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 17 different kind of common things that are involved in remediation, and then the number of screening units included in those. So, for example, electricity use, 1 kilowatt hour translates to 1 screening unit. Materials use, 1 pound translates to 1 screening unit. But when you get to something like diesel or gasoline use, 1 gallon translates to 10 screening units. So it's all basically based on kind of number of estimated or approximate number of millions of BTUs within a certain unit of something. So and all the screening units come out to be approximately somewhere in the general range of 10,000 to 20,000 BTUs. So that page 47 of the methodology, exhibit 3.2, is how I got that.
Okay, so you're converting them all to energy.
I'm converting them all to energy screening units, and each screening unit happens to be in the general range of 10,000 to 20,000 BTUs.
Okay.
Okay, thanks for that question. An FYI from ISIS Long, Department of Navy Environmental Restoration in I think they're in Port Hueneme. That SiteWise has been updated to version 2 and is available to the public along with an online tutorial. Okay, so I have a question here from Mark Ambler, Western Solutions in Honolulu. Question is, in Hawaii, energy use is substantially more expensive since it originates primarily from petroleum-based power plants. Is there incorporation of factors related to energy origin in the analysis? So I'd leave that to, again, Doug or Karen on the footprint side.
Energy origin. Certainly when we're looking at electricity use, the way that the methodology handles that is it really asks you to try to use the local energy mix when you are trying to estimate what the footprint is associated with, say, kilowatt hour of electricity. We recognize that that will change anywhere in the continental United States based on whether a region or a local utility is using a lot of coal or a lot of hydro or a lot of natural gas or nuclear, or in the case of Hawaii, a lot of, say oil. So we do, the methodology does suggest that someone uses as local information as possible when generating the footprints associated with electricity generation.
But this is Karen, and I would just add, if the question is also getting at the question of the actual origin of the fossil fuels and the extraction of the fossil fuels, yes, the methodology does take that into consideration and works that into the final footprint number. But the methodology uses general average numbers for that. So a site in Hawaii would be using the same average number. I mean, applying the methodology for a site in Hawaii versus a site in Maine or a site in Florida, you would all use the same average footprint number for extracting the fossil fuel. So we wouldn't tailor it to the particular location in that sense regarding extraction of the fossil fuels, but you could make that refinement yourself on top of what the methodology already has outlined.
Okay, other questions on the phone lines. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute and identify yourself.
Hi, this is Zach Schreiber from the City of New York. I had a follow-up question on the screening strategy that's been used. It seems that energy is being used as a proxy for prioritizing the assessment of the life cycle of the materials being used in the assessment. And I wonder if that has any side effects if we look at, for example, toxicity. And I don't have any specific example off the top of my head, but if we look at toxicity, it's not always directly correlated with mass and then the conversion of that into energy. So I wonder if there are any potential impacts that will be missed by using this one simplified proxy for the screening.
You're raising a very, very fair questions, and I think there's multi dimensions to that question. Let me start simple and then see if I can expand and ultimately hopefully reach an answer to your question. On slide 26, which is where I first talk about the screening limits, we talk about applying the screening limits to various metric categories so that you're not just using the energy screening process for everything. So when you're trying to do your materials footprint or your materials metric, you're going to apply screenings to materials use. And then when you're doing waste, you're going to apply screening limits to your waste. And when you're doing, there's actually screening limits associated, that you derive for on-site NOx, SOx, and PM emissions and on-site HAP emissions. So so theoretically, you're covering a bunch of different bases there by applying the screening limits to various metrics rather than just energy. When you apply the screening limits to just energy, we are doing that, and we're making the general assumption, and of course people are willing to go much further than that, that that's a reasonable representation of what would also screen out for things like carbon footprint overall, NOx, SOx, plus PM emissions overall, HAP emissions, those sort of things. So that is a general assumption. We could have certainly gone into more and said, hey, apply the screening to all these different things, but that just would have made things far more complicated. And there are certainly examples where this would fall short. For example, if you were using a lot of renewable energy, then certainly you would have a high, some high energy numbers associated with some of your renewable energy use, but you might have very low carbon footprint numbers or NOx and SOx numbers or hazardous air pollutant numbers because you're using renewable energy that just didn't have those types of emissions associated with them. When those types of situations arise, then I think it merits looking at some of those, taking that into consideration when you're trying to screen things out. Another dimension to your question is, are we missing any impacts? Certainly there's some, by tracking hazardous air pollutants, we're tracking something that could be, is considered toxic. But there's a lot of things that the methodology, we focused on the metrics we show here, like carbon and NOx and SOx and materials and whatnot. We did not focus on things like mercury releases to water or other heavy metals or other things, unless they happen to be HAP emissions. So, at some point, if your site or you're concerned about that type of exposure or toxicity, you're starting to get in the realm of a life cycle assessment, which is certainly worthwhile to do in many cases. But I think that it adds a whole other level of complexity to the analysis, which when we're trying to find the kind of happy medium to keep it streamlined enough that people can do it, that type of analysis got left off in favor of people who would want to go that extra mile and do the LCA analysis. So I hope I sort of answered your question.
Yeah, definitely. That helps. Thanks.
Okay. Other questions from the phone lines?
Yeah, hi. This is Beth Moore.
Oh, hi, Beth. Long time no hear. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah, I'm doing really well. Thank you. I thought your training was really good. I'm with Department of Energy, and I've been reviewing the application of the evaluation tool for on-site versus off-site disposal units. And I was wondering if you folks have any applications for that usage so far.
You mean sites where we've done the methodology and derived that on-site versus off-site?
Yeah. For CERCLA-type waste disposal units, in terms of looking at the metrics for the footprint and the reduction in those different emissions?
Beth, this is Doug speaking. The site that I base this kind of hypothetical example that we walk through on this, you know, in the, as part of this training. The actual site that this is loosely based on, I came across that they were generating something on the order of, you know, a lot of tons of hazardous waste. And because of where it was generated and where they needed to dispose of it, it was quite a long haul. And so when you look at the footprint associated with that long haul plus the actual footprint of the disposal, it actually came out of an optimization evaluation where we actually suggested potentially looking at on-site waste disposal, creating on-site, you know, waste management unit and all that sort of stuff that would you know, very well apply, especially if there's a lot of ongoing activity at the site in the future. And that certainly came out of an optimization type study where we were looking at the potential footprint reduction associated with that.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that with me. Department of Energy is looking at doing a lot of decommissioning and decontamination of very large footprints of sites, as you can imagine. And an on-site versus off-site disposal unit is the calculation that we have to do to get stakeholder and regulatory buy-in. And for that kind of evaluation that we're doing, we haven't done that yet. And so I just wanted to know, you know, how much practical experience we have that we can bring to bear on that. And I think that it might also be really interesting to bring the regulators, the state and the EPA regulators, into that conversation, because they may not be aware of that kind of decision-making process. So it sounds like you may have done it on a smaller scale, but like
And just to clarify, it was a smaller scale, and it was an optimization recommendation, not so much something that was formally attacked, you know, formally pursued by the site team.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. It seems to me that a lot of the benefits of the sustainability analysis could be very good for waste management decisions. You know, short term and life cycle. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. I really enjoyed your teaching.
Thank you, Beth. We have a similar question, or maybe not that similar, but Paul Pamontier, the Source Group in Signal Hill, California. The question is there a future plan to include a quantitative evaluation of the weight of the green criterion in comparison with risk and cost when selecting the remedy? For example, X tons of CO2 would allow for an added incremental residual site risk of 10^-5 for remediation option. And similar to this question related to cost. Early in the in this webinar, we discussed a little bit of the policy background and very generally how remedy selection has not changed. And what men intended to suggest there, or meant to say, is that the remedy selection process, particularly in Superfund, has not changed. The fact that we have a footprint evaluation methodology and that we have a green remediation policy has not changed the remedy selection process. The data that footprint evaluation does generate can be incorporated into, you know, existing, you know, 9 criteria processes. And we'll be to have some clarification on that pretty soon. But it does not significantly affect the remedy selection process. Kira, if you're still there, if there's anything you'd like to add to that, I know you had some early experience in this area.
Carlos, you might ask if Kira is still on mute. She may be speaking, but on mute.
Yeah, I'm going to give you a second to see if Kira, remember it's #6 to go off mute. Okay, she's not there. Hillary, is there anything else that you'd like to add to that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Are there other questions on the phone lines, please? Okay, I do have a question here from Angela Fisher. It's back to the screen limits. We seem to have a few questions in that topic. It's, how do you determine the selected magnitude-based limit? Or you're screening less.
Again, that is a professional judgment. It's a professional judgment call. If we go back to slide number, see if I can get that. Slide number 26. If we look down, you go down to the second to last row, on-site HAPS. Here, the engineering estimate that, or the professional judgment said the largest contributor was natural gas, and that based on that, if you go through all the calculations, looks like about a contribution about 5 pounds, which is a very low number. And if you do the one percentage, contribution of that, which again, that 1% is also just based on professional judgment as to what's necessary for the project, you'd get to 0.05 and you'd be like, geez, well, 0.05, that's such a small amount of hazardous air pollutants to track on site. It's going to drive us crazy, and does it really amount to anything? And you can see if you go one step over and you see the magnitude limit set at 10, well, that 10 was based on something that was, it was a professional judgment call. Hey, we'll be interested in something that generates more than 10 pounds of hazardous air pollutants. It really depends on your site team, your particular site, what you find is important and worthwhile tracking. I think that's the best answer I can give, Carlos. We didn't want to be too prescriptive on that.
Okay, thank you. Hillary, we have a couple of questions from Dorothy Allen, the Mass DEP, and Shannon Ridley in Georgia, EPD, both of them related to whether or not EPA is planning to do training for the state program partners. It's almost identical question from both of those people.
I know that states are welcome to attend the NARPM training conference. We have a number of state folks that attend NARPM each year. And as I mentioned on the slide, there will be training at NARPM, a four-hour session on the methodology. It's possible that regional folks will do outreach to the states in their regions. I know that has happened in some regions around the country, and these clue-in webinars are open to our state folks. Those are the training initiatives that I can think of that would be open to state folks. If you're aware of something else, Carlos, feel free to...
Now you mentioned that your engineering forum colleague, Julie Santiago, in Region 9, she is organizing a training that will, include both from Cal, EPA, DTSC. I'm not sure if that's been finalized. So if you want to send us an email, we'll follow up on that. And then we're also working with our colleagues in Region 5 in Chicago and Region 4, Candace, on trying to get some training organized. So we do hope to be able to get out to the regions as well, and with live in-person training in addition to webinar training.
Carlos, this is Julie Santiago in Region 9. We'll be conducting very similar training in May 16th, but our states are going to be invited, meaning the states that are covered in this region, and some of them have been contacted already. If you are a state within Region 9 and you're interested in participating via phone, just let me know. My information appears in the Engineering Forum contact page as part of the methodology contact.
Thanks, Julie. Jean, if you're still there, I've lost my internet connection. I can't see the online questions. I'd like to hand it over to you at this point because I can't read the questions.
Okay, no problem, Carlos. You have to bear with me as I kind of go through some of the ones that you may or may not have addressed. So the next one I guess I'm going to ask is coming in from Vienna, Virginia, and they were asking if CO2 mass emitted from the primary metric, if it is the primary metric for evaluating comparing footprints.
This is Karen. I'll take that one. We like to look at our metrics as more overarching and comprehensive than just CO2. So as you noticed in one of the earlier tables that Doug showed, we
we find other metrics to be also of great importance, including water usage and the NOx, SOx, and PM and the HAPS emissions, as well as materials usage and waste generation. So we consider all of those metrics to be important. And we try to avoid the path of looking only at CO2 and seeing that as the biggest and most important metric. We do not see it that way. We see CO2 as one of an array of metrics, all of which should be considered. And then depending on your site and depending on your situation, you may focus in on a handful of those 15 metrics as most relevant to your site that may or may not include CO2. We really see it as tailoring the approach to your site and your remedy. And again, it may be different for different sites and different remedies. And we like to be as comprehensive as possible in considering all of those 15 metrics or the ones that are the most relevant to our site.
Okay, great. Does anyone have any other comments to that question? Okay. And again, my apologies if you guys have covered this one. But just double-checking, if for the new worksheets that were posted on CLUIN, someone from Region 3 is asking if there's an example of the, quote, correct path name, that they have been playing around with the spreadsheets and they can't get anything to work.
I guess the first thing is make sure all three workbooks are saved in the same directory. But Doug, if you have any information.
There's something with the some of the Microsoft Excel files have a security setting on them, such that when you open them, at the top you have to click on something to enable editing, and you need to make sure that you enable editing. And it just happens once. It's a security setting that anytime you get a file from the internet, whether it's email or downloaded, Microsoft tends to ask you for permission to enable editing. You need to do that for all three of the spreadsheets one time, and once you do that, that should allow them to be linking to each other. But if you don't have that button clicked, it will prevent them from linking. So that might be the problem that people are running into. And then I think the other thing that Sandra said before she printed that or put them on, there is a Excel, the latest version of Excel is the best one to be using. That there were might have been some issues with some earlier versions of Excel.
And this is Karen. I would just add that if all three workbooks are in the same folder, you don't have to enter anything in the path name block on your worksheets.
Yeah. As downloaded, once you do that enable editing, as downloaded, those things should link automatically. I've tried it several times today and in previous days, and they were working fine on my machine.
Okay, thanks, guys.
And again, my apologies, but I'm going to ask a question that was regarding the changes that you're going to make to the spreadsheets. This is coming in from Portland, and they were wondering how you're going to document changes to the spreadsheets from this point forward. In other words, update them. How can they find out that there have been an updated version of the spreadsheets released?
If we update them, they will be... we'll post them in the same place, and it will be either the file name or on that section of green remediation, we will state what has changed. We don't expect to do little incremental changes unless it's a minor fix here and there, and those are appreciated. But that same place where it was downloaded, the version that was uploaded today is the first one, and as we make improvements going forward, that's the place where we'll be releasing them.
Okay, great. Our next question is coming in from Trenton, New Jersey, and they ask, as a main goal of doing this analysis is improving the footprint of a remediation, how many alternatives would you recommend evaluating in an optimization-based evaluation? And they ask if it would be site-specific. And I can reread that question if you need me to.
Okay. I guess we're trying to figure out. I mean, there's, of course, the slide that Kira came up with, which had several examples. So there's no, I mean, Doug, you've done a lot of the optimizations. We're not providing any recommendation of how many iterations of a remedy or how many options should be considered.
I think there's a couple different ways that I guess I could answer that question. Usually when I do a footprint analysis, I'm doing a footprint analysis based on alternatives or various recommendations that came out of, say, an optimization report. So maybe I have an operating pump and treat system. I do an optimization evaluation, or someone else does one, and there are several different potential recommendations to implement. The ones that kind of make it through the process and say, hey, yeah, we're interested in doing these, those are the ones that tend to get the footprint analysis done on them. And so I guess it's the optimization that comes first in the footprint analysis that seems to follow suit, and then you can kind of iterate back and forth between the two of them. So I guess that's one potential answer to it, and certainly optimization recommendations, the number of them would be a site-specific sort of thing. the other aspect of it is that when you run your numbers for a footprint analysis, it suggests, you know, there's going to be some uncertainty, especially the earlier you are in the remedial process, the less certain some of your numbers are going to be. For example, if you run a footprint analysis based on doing one bioremediation injection event, you might want to go back and say, well, what happens if I go back and do two or three or four of these with differing amounts of oil or different amendments, and how does that change things? How does that change my monitoring? And kind of fool around with doing different analyses so you can have a better understanding of how your footprint numbers, how your metric values change with your level of certainty or kind of what the range is for the analysis that you're doing. I don't think any of us here want to say that the number that comes out of an analysis is a number to bank on, because there's always going to be uncertainty throughout that process, and you want to have a handle on what that uncertainty is and what a reasonable range of values is.
So, right, and I can just go stepping back a bit. Let's not forget that the driver here in a site cleanup is always going to be protectiveness of human health and the environment. And that's what's going to determine if you need to look at other iterations of a remedy or other remedy options that achieve that protectiveness that you're seeking. The green remediation analysis is an incremental improvement on that protectiveness, but ultimately that is what we are seeking. And additionally, as Doug is mentioning, if you're doing a remedy optimization, you're looking at remedy components and how you can achieve the same protectiveness with a streamlined remedy. And on the after that analysis has been completed, or in conjunction with analysis, is when we would do the footprint evaluation. So we don't see a situation where footprint evaluation or green remedy is going to be the main driver for decision making.
I think that's really important, Carlos, because I think that from the standpoint, it really needs to be looked at it from the standpoint of optimizing a remedial strategy that's already been selected, as opposed to a factor that's going to be considered that's going to select one remedy over another.
Okay, excellent. Are there any other comments or statements regarding that question? Okay. Well, in the interest of time, seeing as how we're coming up on the 2:58 Eastern time point and our session is scheduled to end at 3, I'll offer our presenters an opportunity to make any closing statements or comments before I provide the instructions on how to submit feedback as well as access resources related to today's session. So, Carlos, I'll go ahead and start with you. If you have any closing statements or comments, please feel free.
Thanks, Jean. No, mostly to thank everybody for participating. And as I mentioned early on, for those of you who have provided input, comments, written, verbal, or participated in previous webinars and provided your thoughts, are greatly appreciated on for the development of the methodology. I noticed quite a few questions about this. And as I mentioned, thoughts or recommendations on improvements on those are also very much welcome. And, of course, thank the speakers and all those identified in the agency and other partners in developing the methodology. And thanks for your help with this, Jean.
No problem. Karen, out in Region 9, do you have any closing statements?
No, that's it. I just would reiterate what Carlos said. Thank you for the participants and participating in the webinar, and thanks for the questions, which were very, very good to hear and good to have discussion on.
Great, thanks. Kira in Region 10.
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Jane.
Okay. Hillary out in Region 3.
I just encourage folks to visit cluein.org/green remediation. Lots of good resources and tools there.
Thanks, Hillary. And Doug Sutton.
Just one closing statement. I got some email fodder during the presentation that suggested that the cost range that we provided might be on the higher conservative side, which is what we were intending to do. But I think that just to shy away from it, that shouldn't be a cost estimate that should scare people away, because it could probably be much cleaner and cheaper to do, or more cost effective to do, especially if your existing site team who's already familiar with the with the data, and you have a report that you could fit it into, you could probably get away with something that's a little bit more reasonable or lower in cost that might not be as discouraging to some people out there. So I think just the general comment that the costs posted hopefully are not overly discouraging to some of the people in the audience.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. With that, I'm going to direct everybody along to slide number 67, which has two important links that we referenced earlier today. The first is a link to the additional resources page, and the second is a link to our short feedback form. The resources, if you're not at a computer with internet access right now, you can actually find that there's a button on the seminar homepage that says links, and that'll bring you to the very same collection of not only PowerPoint presentations, but other resources that were pulled together related to today's seminar. So I would encourage you, if you haven't done so, go ahead and take a look at the resources that our presenters have pulled together for today's talk. And that second link, the short feedback form, takes about a minute or two to fill out. We would ask that you do that. I do read each and every one of the comments that are submitted this way. If you shared the line with multiple participants, once you submit feedback, there'll be a link you can click to have the other person or other individuals at your office each take their own turns and fill out their own feedback form. And the other thing I would mention is that if you are looking to get credit for your participation today, while we can't provide you CEUs or PDHs, you may find that downloading a copy of the presentation material along with submitting feedback and getting a confirmation message from us regarding your feedback will be enough to earn credit from your accrediting institution. So when you fill out the feedback form, you do have an option to check a box, and we can send a confirmation message to you by email, at least confirming that you did submit feedback after the session was over. Again, you just want to be sure that your email address is entered correctly. And I believe that's the end of the reminders that I have for slide number 67. I'm going to push everybody on to the very final slide, which is number 68, and just letting everybody know, if you're new to Cluein or hadn't heard, we actually now have new ways to stay connected with us, in addition to offering free internet seminars, developing publications, and offering other web resources via the Cluein website. We have other presences that you can choose to follow us, whether you want to listen in on our podcast through iTunes, you choose to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, or you take advantage of some of our new networking tools, including our Facebook and Twitter pages. We would encourage you to stay connected with us. We also will be announcing a new LinkedIn group as well starting May 1st. So I would encourage you guys to check us out and follow us or like us if you haven't done so already. So on slide number 68, I'd like to again extend my thanks, as Carlos did, to all of the organizers from across EPA, as well as some of our outside support partners who helped us pull together today's presentation. And I want to thank the over 250 individuals that joined us from all over the world, actually, to participate in today's Cluein seminar. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. As I mentioned, today's session was recorded, and the entire archive will automatically be emailed to you within 1 to 2 weeks. And if you think it's useful, you can certainly forward that on to a colleague. And we would encourage you to take a look at some of the other archive seminars we have available on the Cluein archive page. So with that, again, I extend my thanks to everybody who joined us and helped make the session happen today. And this will be the formal conclusion for today's seminar. Thank you all. I hope you have a great rest of your day.